This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Well, hello, everyone. It's Nate. Welcome to episode 377 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And this week, we have on the show with us Janie Hendrix, who, of course, you know as Jimi Hendrix's sister, but she's also CEO of Experience Hendrix LLC, the Jimi Hendrix estate, producer of just about every Jimi Hendrix record released in the last two decades. And now, Janie is author of the book Jimi, which came out originally in November in time for Jimmy's 80th birthday and immediately sold out. I mean, you could not find a copy of this book anywhere. It's a fantastic book. It's beautiful. And guess what, people? There's now another print ready for early March. You could pre-order it now anywhere you get your books. It is absolutely incredible. I enjoyed it immensely. And now Janie is on the Vinyl Guide this week to share tales of her times with her brother Jimmy, clarify stories, discuss what's in the Hendrix vault, and ultimately, what's coming up next for releases in the Jimi Hendrix universe. And really quick, there is an extended version of this interview only available to Patreon supporters of the show. Head up there now, patreon.com/vinylguide. We give all sorts of extra stuff to people who love to buy me a monthly beer at patreon.com/vinylguide. So if you're a patron of the show, head up there now and enjoy the extended, high-resolution, and commercial-free version of this interview. If you're not a member, well, that could change right now. Head up to patreon.com/vinylguide. Sign up to help support the show and get all the extras. And finally, don't forget to follow the Vinyl Guide podcast in your podcast app. Each week, we nerd out and talk records with another artist or influencer. People like Ben Blackwell of Third Man Records talking White Stripes history and more. Episode 374, Patty Boyd, the former Mrs. George Harrison and Eric Clapton, episode 370, Gerald V. Casale of Devo, episode 366, Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull, episode 331, Robbie Krieger of The Doors, episode 306, Peter Frampton, episode 300, Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, talking lots of Hendrix stories, episode 293, and lots more. Follow the Vinyl Guide in your podcast app and access the other 370-something interviews of the Vinyl Guide podcast. So there we go. The upfronts are done. Let's get into our conversation with Janie Hendrix on the legacy of her brother, Jimmy. All right, this week on The Vinyl Guide, we are very honored to have Janie Hendrix here talking about a myriad of things, but we're going to focus quite a bit on the new book, Jimmy. It's a beautiful book. I just read it. Gorgeous pictures. Janie, thank you for your time. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Now, I got to tell you, I am in awe of what the Hendrix team has done. You and John and Eddie Kramer in the last several years of pulling all these artifacts and recordings together. I think it's just incredible what you're doing for your brother's legacy. Let's talk a little bit about the archive. There's an archive of Jimmy material, recording, stage clothing, and that sort of stuff. Is that right?
Yes, plural. Archives. Yes.
Archives. Can you describe those? Like, what are the different archives?
Well, we have all of the recordings, both audio and visual, in a temperature-controlled vault that is very large. And then we have his clothing in another location. And we have photos and handwritten lyrics and all of that in another location.
Tell me about when he started pulling together these archives, because I guess at some point after Jimmy's passing, a lot of his materials just were scattered kind of to the wind. What was the moment that it kind of dawned on the family to start pulling this stuff together?
Well, first of all, when Jimmy passed away, you're right, everything was in a disarray, didn't have a will. It took about 4 years to get everything situated. And we relied a lot on an attorney that we had at the time who spent 20 years overseeing things with another gentleman, or I should say that, another man, called Alan Douglas. And that went on for like 20 years. And then we heard a rumor that Leo Branton, our attorney, was trying to sell our rights for a huge gain for himself. And we started a lawsuit. Took us about 2.5 years, thanks to Paul Allen, who loaned us money to get our rights back. And we were able to pay him back every cent.
Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft.
Yeah. True. Paul Allen was a big fan. So he had Mopop. Prior to that, it was called Experience Music Project. And he assisted us in getting our rights back. So we paid him back every cent. Started Experience Hendrix and Authentic Hendrix when we got our rights back. And we went to work because even though we got our rights back, the court ordered everything to come back to us that our former attorney had. Of course, a lot of things were just still scattered everywhere because Alan Douglas didn't take care of it very well. And we had to go hunting. Fortunately, John McDermott is a great historian, and he kind of knew where all the bones and the bodies were buried, and we were able to go find tapes and people that have filmed things that were kind of stiffed for payment from the old administration. We worked out deals with them. We bought a lot of photographs, and it's just been a journey of hunting and gathering, really. And then a lot of the items that are found in the book, like Jimmy's handwritten lyrics and his drawings and paintings, my dad kept all of that, especially from Jimmy's childhood, of course. And then some of the items that were done later in his life, we were able to acquire them from various collectors.
Now, the records from his youth, as you describe in the book, were those records still around?
Well, first I'll say the records from Jimmy's youth were actually my father's records. So they were, my dad was a big collector of the blues, and he also liked jazz and R&B, of course. And so the vinyl collection from Jimmy's youth really belonged to my father. We had it on display at one point at Experience Music Project when it was called that at the time. So, yes, we still have them.
Any idea what happened to Jimmy's record collection from 69 or 70?
Jimmy's records, we didn't end up getting back, unfortunately. After he passed away, a lot of it was kind of a free-for-all for a lot of his clothing, guitars, and whatnot. And the management and his attorneys didn't follow my dad's instructions when he went to New York and asked that they ship everything back. He was given the question, why? Why? Why do you want them? Why should we send it back to you? So we got some things. We didn't get everything. And so when you see a lot of things up for auction, we never sell anything that we got back of Jimmy's. That's all people that either acquired them from someone that got it honestly or dishonestly, as you would say. That's what happened in the studio and his apartment.
Or they could be counterfeits. I imagine there's quite a bit of Jimi Hendrix counterfeit material out there.
There's a lot of counterfeit, of course, because it's like my dad used to he had printed up a bunch of pictures of family photos that he would give to people if they came to our house, and a lot of people would come to our house. And then later in life, I'd find his autograph on something that it said, oh, Al Hendrix gave me the scarf. And it's like, no, he didn't. He gave you a photo and you lifted his autograph and then you put it on a note that said it's a scarf. But my dad didn't give out scarves and shirts or guitars or any of that. He hung on to all of that.
That's interesting and kind of weird. People would come to your house after Jimmy's passing. Was that a problem back in the day?
I don't think it was ever looked at like a problem until somebody decided to break in and steal a bunch of stuff. But usually, like growing up, people would say that they hitchhiked from Florida or, you know, we're in town, they wanted to see the cemetery and they would stop by our house. And it was just a normal, I don't know, everyday occurrence pretty much. And if they came, a lot of times my parents would offer them dinner. We didn't even know some of these people. Thank God they weren't serial killers. But no, they'd come and sit and have dinner with us and whatnot. My dad was very generous with his time that way. And, you know, he would show them postcards that Jimmy had wrote through the years or his time as 101st Airborne paratrooper or something. Fortunately, my dad had a guest book, so he used to have people sign it. So back in 1986, someone came by and they signed the guest book, and later that week broke into my dad's house, stole the gold albums. So that all got filed as a police report. So whenever there's an auction, at least that comes up to let us know. But so far, the person that did it, which we know who it is, but they have not sold it yet. So,
oh, okay. So you know it's out there. It's one of those things that will hopefully return back to the family at some point.
Yeah, probably after the person passes. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Everything seems back home at some point.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, you got someone like yourself, you know, keeping tabs on it and fighting to get it back. What is out there that you know exists that, like, recording wise, that hasn't been added to the archive yet?
There's a lot. I mean, Jimmy did. He worked very hard in 4 years. You know, my dad had a really great work ethic, which he passed on to Jimmy and myself. And it's like, so he was constantly working on his music, whether he's recording in his apartment on like a four track, or if he's in the studio, Electric Lady, or just on the road in a hotel room. Also, there were a lot of shows, a lot of live shows. Not all were recorded, but, you know, we've managed to, we always put the word out, like if you were at this concert, even if you recorded it from your handheld tape recorder or back then like a boombox, whatever, it's like, you know, we would like to have that. And Eddie is a master in the studio as far as cleaning things up. I think really technology has finally caught up to Jimmy. So cleaning up tape has become much better than it was decades ago. So anyways, whatever we can get our hands on, there's a lot out there still that we don't have that we would love to have in our collection and be able to clean it up and present it to the fans the way it should be heard and enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. So you know of some recordings that do exist. They just haven't been, as you say, brought back home yet.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. So I got a question on several recordings, and these are recordings that that were noted in the book. Or gigs, special events. And I want to just see if there's a recording, if you know of it or not. First off, Jimmy played the Apollo, won $25 at a time that apparently, according to the book, he was quite destitute at the time. That $25 sounded like it came in handy. Any idea what he played that night, or if there are any recordings or pictures of that?
I have no idea. I'd love to see if, I don't know if the Apollo recorded it. I do can tell you this. Jimmy called home that night and he was scared. He was scared to death that people were going to start throwing fruit or chairs or something at him, because that's, you know, kind of like the Gong Show. Sometimes the Apollo was known, if people didn't like you, they started throwing stuff at you. And then when it was over, he called and he was so excited that he won and that nobody threw. More importantly, the fact that he won the money and, you know, the acknowledgement, but that nobody threw anything at him. Actually, was thrilled that no one threw anything at him.
This is kind of in the early to mid 60s. Did Jimmy call the family a lot while he was out on the road?
He did. He'd always call and let us know like where he was and what he was doing, even if it was just a couple minute phone call, because back then, you know, unlike now where you don't get charged for long distance calls, everything was a charge and usually call collect. So it would just be like, just to let everyone know he's okay and this is what's happening, or I'm on my way to Europe, or hey, I'm in Europe and they put a band together and there's these two white guys that have hair like me. I mean, these are all like the conversations of the phone calls. And I'm going to start using my name, my full name, but I'm going to change the spelling to J-I-M-I, which my dad thought was really cool. Because prior to that, he's going by like Jimmy James, or, you know, James Maurice, or some other name rather than his own. So he was really happy. He knew my dad would be happy that he was using his given name.
It's interesting because in the book, there's a picture of an early experience picture that actually has J-I-M-M-Y on the the banner in the background. So that there was still a bit of a transition there. Any thoughts, any ideas or understanding of when he shortened it or why?
Okay, so actually it was, I think it said J-I-M-M-I, but that was on the promoters and the people of the venue. That wasn't what they were told. Okay. I think J-I-M-I, well, Jimmy was the first one to use it that way, at least that we know of. And so when he went to London with Chaz to meet Eric Clapton and to for them to put the band around him, Chaz, that's when he changed his name.
Mm, okay.
Or the spelling of it, not really changing his name, but the spelling of Jimmy.
Just shorten it, made it a little bit more unique, seemed the right idea.
It's very unique. A lot of people are doing it now. I always watch like the credits and movies and whatnot. It's like, oh, they're using J-I-M-I. That's pretty cool.
Okay. So in the book, again, you talk about Sue Records run by Juggy Murray. And in the book, it said that he signed a management deal with them. He was then brought to the studio a few times, but they couldn't really work out kind of what to do with Jimmy. This is early in his career. Any idea if there are recordings from those sessions available?
You know, I really don't know. Again, it's like we always are hopeful. And if somebody has something like that, if it was done, then the universe seems to answer. So since you've now verbally put it out there, hopefully someone will hear that and go, hey, I have something in my closet for you.
Well, that's the most we can hope for. And by the way, I warned you we'd get a little bit nerdy. So apologies if we go deep on some of these things.
It's like
the book, I kept reading the book and it just kept inspiring me. Like, what happened there? What's under this rock here? Any recordings from the Café Hua period?
Again, I have no idea if there were. I think we have asked in the past, but you know, people were able to just go there and jam, and it wasn't like they had a board. And right. Even now, like when I go to the Café Hua, I don't think they're recording people. So unfortunately, unless somebody had a handheld, which again, maybe one of your listeners does. So if anyone has any photos or audio recording or video, we would love to chat with you.
Pictures. Now I did hear a recording online. I don't know how legit it is or not, of what was apparently his last performance at Ronnie Scott's with Eric Burdon and War. And it's on YouTube. It's really muffled. It's pretty hard to enjoy. Do you know if a better copy exists somewhere?
No, I don't know.
Okay.
I've heard it too. I agree with you. But maybe, you know, that'll be another project of ours.
Yeah. We recently had Robbie Krieger of The Doors on. And there's there's a similar recording of their last show with Jim. And the similar quality, and they have no idea what it's like. Maybe we could give it away. It's interesting, but it's hard to enjoy.
Yeah. Robbie's a good golfer. I've played golf with him too.
So. Oh, okay.
I like Robbie. He's been on our Experience Hendrix tours before.
Yeah. Wonderful guy. All right. So when Jimmy was overseas in the UK, he was making a name for himself. This is, I think, 66, 67. Really quite unknown in the U.S. at this time. What were the sort of communications that he was sending back to the family? And how were you guys learning of his newfound stardom overseas?
Yeah, he would call back. He would call home periodically, just letting us know like where he was. That was really important to my dad, just to know like where he was and that he was safe. And, you know, back then, my dad had never been outside the country. So to the fact that Jimmy was, that was pretty cool. The other way, of course, we learned like everyone else learned by reading it. And, you know, because Jimmy really didn't go into like the nitty gritty of what was happening. It was more like how he was and how he was feeling and his fears or people that he was meeting or those kind of insights. But then we would read about it. The Wild Man of Borneo. My dad hated that. He thought, you know, what a horrible racist way of stating who Jimmy was, because that's not who Jimmy was. And he was such a quiet, sweet, kind, talented person. And he had to do what he had to do on stage to get people's attention. But his personality, that wasn't his personality. And don't know. I just remember my dad didn't like that.
Okay. Was he sending like copies of the records back? Like, hey, here's the Hey Joe single, or here's like Are You Experienced, the UK version, I think came out months and months before it came out in the US. Yeah.
Right. So we lived in a triplex, and there are the hippie girls. That's what my parents called them. There are two girls. They live next door. It's like a house that's divided into three, and the walls were thin, and we hear music. And I remember Dad saying, "That's Jimmy playing." I don't know who's singing, but that's Jimmy playing, because in my dad's mind, he didn't really think Jimmy could sing. But when Jimmy phoned home to say that they were forming this band, he said, "Hey, Dad, you know, I'm gonna change the spelling of my name, and hey, I'm gonna try the singing thing out. Everybody else out here hollering, and I'm gonna holler too." So my mom goes next door and she knocks on their door and says, "Can we ask you what record you're playing?" And so she showed her, and it was the Are You Experienced record, and that's how we acquired our first Are You Experienced album, because my mom said, "Hey, that's, you know, our son." And then she, the hippie girl, said, "Oh my God, here, take it, we'll go buy another one." So that's how we got our first one.
Okay, so the way I'm hearing it is Jimmy would call and just give a bit of information, what's happening with him, and, "Oh, hey, yeah, I'm going to make some music. I'm going to cut some records." Very nonchalant. And then you hear about it on this whole other frequency from other people.
I think he just really honestly relied on his management to send us records, but they never did. I remember the last time he was in Seattle, which was July of 1970. He was super excited. Well, actually, I think that was might have been 69, 70. But anyways, last time he was in the show, I was in 70. He was talking about, like, you know, the studio, Electric Lady, and doing Electric Ladyland. And he was very excited to not just be performing on it, but also helping to produce it. And he was learning things from Eddie in the studio. And he knew what he wanted in the studio, but didn't always know, like, what knobs to turn, or, you know, pull and push forward or whatever. So he was learning how to do that. There's pictures of him sitting behind the board, and he's studying what Eddie's doing, because he was wanting to know how to do that, you know, how to mix your songs.
He and Eddie, from what it sounds like, had this incredible language together, because Jimmy, not being a trained engineer, had to describe what he heard in his head for Eddie to be able to try to interpret and recreate it on the board.
Yes, that's true. Jimmy a lot of times talked about things in color. So, like, "I want it to sound blue or red, a little bit of yellow and orange, throw that in there." So that was their own language, and Eddie knew exactly what he wanted.
Right. That's interesting, because as I understand, Frank Zappa had that sort of terminology as well, saw things as colors, but he eventually acquired the skills to be able to engineer himself. Jimmy was also, he showed up on a Zappa cover, "We're Only in It for the Money." Do you know the story of that?
No, I don't. Oh. I know that they were friends. I do know that they performed on a concert together, not together, but, like, you know, with their own bands. And Jimmy gave Frank one of his Fender Strats. It was his Sunburst one. I'm not sure about the "Only in It for the Money" part.
Oh, okay. Well, there's a cover shot for the album that became "We're Only in It for the Money," and it's a Beatles parody of Sgt. Pepper. And instead of the bright sky with the, you know, the Beatles in the middle and everything, it's a dark sky with, you know, lightning bolts and everything. And, you know, instead of flowers, it's just fruit, you know, just typical thumb your nose at the world Zappa kind of stuff. And apparently Jimmy was just hanging around. And they said, "Do you want to come into the photo shoot?" And he did. So he's actually part of that photo shoot.
I see. Well, I do know they're friends. And it's funny that you talk about Frank Zappa, you know, being in the studio and being an engineer, because that's now what Dweezil does. And he's working on, like, Atmos, Engineering, which we are working with him on converting a lot of the songs into an Atmos sound. So it's this full circle, really.
Excellent. Oh, yeah. Dweezil, he's been on our show before. Beautiful guy. In the archive, I imagine there's a lot of test pressings and acetates, perhaps some unique mixes of Jimmy's material from back in the day.
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay. Grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
In the archive, I imagine there's a lot of test pressings and acetates, perhaps some unique mixes of Jimmy's material from back in the day.
Yes, okay. And yes, you're correct.
Okay. Are those recordings that we've been able to hear on some of the more recent issues?
Yes, some have been released, some haven't yet. Some will be released, but all in due time. And fortunately, we are, you know, have been very blessed in being able to acquire more pieces that seem to go with other pieces that we have. So it's great that I'm talking to you right now, because I think that maybe some of your listeners may not even know like what they have in their closets or what their aunts, uncles, grandparents had or something. And maybe that this will inspire them to go look and check it out. And because you never know, there stranger things have happened. We have contacted people that, oh, yeah, you know, my husband was recording there and, oh, let me go check in the attic. And, oh, my gosh, yeah, we have some film and it says Hendrix on it. So those kind of things have happened over the years.
What's the most I guess unique situation where you found this unexpected treasure trove of Hendrix stuff?
Oh my gosh, there's been so many, to tell you the truth. It's like I mean, we have flown pretty much all over the world to meet with people. Some things don't pan out, but other times it's like, I would have to say like Miami Pop was probably one of those magical moments. John made a call to the wife, or actually the widow of the person that had recorded it. And he was at the time like kind of commissioned by Warner Brothers to do the job, but then didn't get paid and they just wanted him to hand it over and he didn't. And so it was up in their attic. And fortunately, we didn't have to bake it and there wasn't any damage to it. And when we ended up taking it to Photochem in Los Angeles and cleaning up each square
frame,
took about a year. Well, they pretty much did that and recolorized everything. And then it was beautiful and it was pristine. And then syncing the music with the film. And that's really what, like, Eddie does. That's his job to do that.
Wow. Okay. So it was a whole concert filmed, pretty much the whole Miami performance filmed. No one had any idea it existed until recent years.
That's correct. Yeah.
Wow. What are some of the strange items in the archive? What's something that, would raise an eyebrow?
I don't know. There's a lot of strange things, but the old administration, when they were running things, they weren't always keeping things authentic. So they would take off tracks like of Mitch and then put in Bruce Gary, the guy that did My Sharona. So anyways, yeah, there's been some strange things like that. So like trying to like clean up and renovate or rejuvenate tapes that someone else tried to destroy for whatever reason. Maybe they were trying to keep it contemporary, but I don't think that's what someone should do. You should always keep it authentic.
I agree. But like items, like anything that's like, oh, this was personal to Jimmy's and it's in the archive for this reason, but it's, yeah.
Okay. Not necessarily music. Interesting. There have been a couple like kooky t-shirts that he used to wear. I think one said like nobody's. I think it was from a restaurant. That was kind of weird. Also, like, you don't really think of Jimmy in like shorts, but he had like these funky jean shorts that the bottom of them looked like a car wash cut, you know, fringy kind of thing that he ended up wearing. I think they went to like Coney Island or something and he was running around in that. So kind of stuff like that. It's kind of not really, I wouldn't have thought that Jimmy would wear some of that. And then I think there was like some kind of trucker hat. That was like when you try to like hide or be incognito or something. Anyways,
when he came back to Seattle in 1970, you know, bona fide superstar at that point, hanging out with the family, was he recognized on the street a lot? Do you have any memories of that sort of, you know, cacophony surrounding him?
Well, first of all, when he came back home, he pretty much hid at home, and so people would come and see him, and then also people would be kind of like hanging out outside pretending like they're going to go mail a piece of letter or something, you know, up at the mailbox, but they really wanted to come in and meet him. He didn't have really, at least in that case, there wasn't like a change of clothes of normal clothes. Like what he wore on stage was his normal clothes. So yeah, he was very recognized. You wear a big hat with a big feather or, you know, like his choice jewelry and all of his fringy jackets. And he had this really cool messenger bag that he used to carry around that had fringe, very native. So people all recognized him.
Okay.
Most of the time, I guess, in our, at least our neighborhood, people left him alone. But, you know, there are people that are just, they want to leave him alone, but they also want like an autograph or a picture with him or something.
They want a moment of some sort. What's your sweetest memory of being with Jimmy on one of the trips he had back to Seattle? What's the memory you keep going back to?
Well, so, you know, there's a picture of Jimmy and I where we're looking at each other backstage and people always say like, what were you guys talking about? And I go, I can remember as though it was yesterday. But he said, you know, you'll never have to worry about anything. I always take care of you. And I said, when I grow up, because I was only six, when I grow up, I'll always take care of you. Now, I thought that he would still be alive while I'm taking care of him. But I always call that the cosmic promise because we both promised each other to take care of each other. And then in one of the pictures, I think it was in 69, picture a self-portrait that Jimmy did of himself. It's a cartoon of himself that he put on that he drew on my hand. And so like in the book, on probably like every few pages, there's these little doodles that Jimmy did in either his journals or on his handwritten lyrics or something painted or drew. And there's these little doodles. They're like little hearts or little arrows or some kind of just little small cute little doodle. And those are on the pages in the book, which I think is really sweet because that really reflects him and how sweet and sometimes innocent and kind he was. I mean, I'm not saying he's innocent because he wasn't, but that is a portion of it, an innocence, you know?
Okay. I do recall seeing all those doodles, and I wasn't sure what they were, but those are Jimmy's doodles. That's amazing.
They are. I think that's what makes it very special and very unique.
Now, you've kept your end of the cosmic promise, clearly. Is there another mountain you want to climb with this? You've made his recordings available. You've remastered things. You've pulled things back to the family, collected and protected the legacy. This book is another piece of that. Is there another mountain that you want to do for the memory of your brother?
I think really more for maybe the memory of my father, because I do it for, you know, all the patrilineal people in my family, but really about how we did get our rights back and the struggles that we had to go through and being able to tell that story, because we spent a few years doing that and how my parents lived and the struggles my dad went through. I think at some point we would like to, John and I have talked about like writing that book and telling that story and what we've gone through to gather up all the tapes and photos and everything that we've been able to gather to carry on Jimmy's legacy and make sure that there are releases for people to enjoy.
That would be fascinating. That is so up my alley here because understanding kind of what went on behind it. Like, for example, your dad probably had to deal with a burden that he didn't expect. He was probably ill-equipped to manage rights and things like that. He was thrust into this situation and, you know, he did his best, but, you know, there's a lot of sharks out there. So that would be an absolutely fascinating tale if you guys were to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've been also exploring, like, you know, there's never been an authorized movie, so we have looked into that. There's just so many facets of the story that it's kind of hard to just put in one movie. So anyways, we've been entertaining doing a movie or at least a series or something.
So the book we've been talking about is Jimmy. It's available now. Grab one from a bookstore. It's really quite gorgeous. You open it up, full color photos. It's a tactile experience. You know, digital just doesn't seem to do this book justice. Although if that's the only way you can get it, then get it, because the story goes into detail and it's told very, very well. There's also the experience live at the Los Angeles Forum, April 26, 1969. That is now available. I believe it's in Dolby Atmos format as well. You could also get vinyl copies. Tell me a little bit about that recording.
Right. So the pieces we had in our vault, and, you know, different songs have been out on different things through the years in the old administration time, but we wanted it to be the running order of the actual concert. Billy was there. Billy's had a blast being able to talk about it, and they were friends. And if you go to the Experience Hendrix website, we put together this kind of little journey of Billy's talking about Hey Now. So he talks about his experience and all that. And the Atmos is just amazing. It's like being immersed. I guess the only thing I can really think of, like, it's like you being immersed in water, but unlike water, how things sound really muddy and you know, blurry, it is so clear. It's like just being like, I don't know, shot out into the atmosphere, but music is just all around you, up, down, every place. And so after we did that with the LA Forum, that's what really has inspired us to want to do that with the other releases that we're able to do it with. We can't do it with all the songs because they weren't recorded in the way that needs to be recorded. But yeah, we will be working on that on some of the other records.
Wow. So some of the other records will be available in the Atmos format. This has been a...
Yes. And actually, Duito will be helping us with that. So we're really excited.
Excellent. All right. We had Billy on our show one time, and he talked about hanging out with Jimmy playing records on tour and that sort of thing. So I'll, if you haven't heard it, I'll send you the link. He had some interesting insights there that that don't come out too much.
That'd be great.
Do you know much about the various covers of the Hendrix album? So, for example, there was a different international version of Band of Gypsies cover. Of course, the Electric Ladyland had multiple covers. Do you know much about the story of why those were different in different countries?
Well, first of all, the Electric Ladyland one with all the naked women, I will tell you this, Jimmy hated that. There's a picture of him like biting it because he was so angry. I remember him even telling me, because they used to be sold in stores in a paper bag or, you know, wrapper, and he'd tell me not to look at it because I was a kid. But for Electric Ladyland, Jimmy had a specific design of what he wanted. Kind of, you know, that whole like shot with the kids at Central Park on the Alice in Wonderland statue, and he had it drawn out. And so when we redid Electric Ladyland, we had his drawings as he drew them up for Warner Brothers to say, this is how I wanted. A lot of times it was the management not listening to what Jimmy wanted, and you have different photographers in different countries and whatnot. But you know, when we got the rights back, we had to, I guess, reverse a lot of things the old administration did, because though I love Jared Mankiewicz, but I would have never used his photos to put on the cover of Our Experience and Axis and Electric Ladyland, maybe some other album, but you don't touch those. Those are iconic. And you know, I think they've even won awards for being so amazing. So the ones that were released in America, other than Electric Ladyland, were choices of Jimmy, the Are You Experience and Axis. But the Electric Ladyland, he had a different vision. And so we tried to honor that when we.
Those are the Linda McCartney photos in Central Park on the Rock and whatnot.
And to this day, you know, Paul McCartney, when he performs, he always makes sure that he gives a nod to Jimmy. He'll play Foxy Lady. And then he tells the story about how when they were in the studio and they let Jimmy listen to Sgt. Pepper. And then he invited him out to the speakeasy. And then he saw them coming. And his very quirky personality was like, oh, okay, there you guys are. Gives everyone a nod and then starts playing Sgt. Pepper in kind of a more jazzy way. And Paul looks at the guys and says, we got to go back in the studio and do it like that.
As I recall, that was 3 days after Sgt. Pepper came out. So he only had, he had a short period of time. It was clear that he was a fan.
Yes. But he had only heard it once, and that was from them. So that's pretty cool.
So are there any recordings that are with Jimmy and other musicians that are unable to be released because of those other musicians?
Well, not really so much. I mean, you know, there was a where Jimmy played with Stevie Wonder. He's playing drums, but that came out on our BBC sessions. There are a lot of, I mean, usually like people that he played with, we don't have a problem with clearance. So you just pay a little money for a license.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Cause I know he recorded with so many different people. I'm wondering if there's a recording out there squirreled away of Jimmy with a Beatle or two that people are just trying to figure out. Maybe it's, I mean, there's a lot of, there could be recordings that aren't that great, you know, and it was an off night. So more curious as to what may exist.
We work with the Apple people, and if there was one, we have worked on projects together, it wouldn't be a problem. But don't know if there is one, you know. There used to be speculation and hopes that there was one with Miles and Jimmy, but unfortunately that never came to fruition. I had a chance to meet some of the band members of Chicago when I was in Los Angeles the last time, and you know, a lot of people don't know this, but Chicago opened for Jimmy like 18 concerts, I think it was. And so they had talked about creating that album together. And unfortunately, that never happened. So there's always like these talks of creating albums, you know, or with, Yeah, different groups, but unfortunately, Jimmy didn't live long enough to make that happen.
Got it.
But, you know, he recorded with Steve Winwood and Stephen Stills, and so we do have those, and we have put those out.
Wonderful. Well, look, Janie, it's been an absolute pleasure, and again, I can't express how nice it is to be able to see the Hendrix legacy being treated with such respect and reverence by you and the team. Pretty much anything that that the Hendrix team puts out, especially on vinyl, I get, because Jimmy's one of those musicians that any time of day I could put on, I absolutely enjoy. I just, the other day, I listened, I kid you not, to Songs for Groovy Children from beginning to end, all 8 records, and I didn't get tired of it once. It was just such a soulful collection, and I really like the fact that you guys are digging in, you're finding these rare nuggets, you're sharing not only the music, but they all come with booklets, with stories, you know, you're talking about the details and the legend of Jimmy, and it really is a blessing for music nerds like myself. So thanks again for doing what you do and steering the steering the ship and putting them all together. And I implore all listeners, if you have any connections with Jimmy or any performances or any activity, if you were in the same city as he was back in the day, if you have any artifacts, reach out to Janie and the Hendrix team. You can find their contact details at jimmyhendrix.com. Janie, thank you again so much.
Thanks so much, Nate. God bless.
Thank you so much, Janie, for coming on The Vinyl Guide. And again, I want to remind folks, this book, Jimmy, it's beautiful, full color pages. It's a gorgeous package. It tells a great story about the history, the legacy of Jimi Hendrix. You can find that wherever fine books are sold or stolen. And again, don't forget there's an extended version of this interview only for patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. And that is it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them out on Facebook. Post them in various groups. You know, there's Jimi Hendrix groups out there. There's classic rock groups out there. Go ahead and copy and paste these URLs and put them in there. People will love you for it, especially me. And also, a huge help is to leave us a positive review on iTunes. Head up there, give us 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10 stars. The most you can give, say a nice review. That is always appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some music, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.